We'll do it live!
You are listening to the AMC Report with your host, Ryan Nelson.
Okay, back on the show, as promised, is David Cole, or David Stein. What do you prefer to go by? David Stein now, I guess? I don't know.
You know, it's a hard thing to say, Rye, because I've been answering to David Stein for almost 18 years, and that's a very hard habit to break. For a dog, definitely, and for a human, almost as much. Now, I think I'm slightly smarter than a dog, and yet all the same, I am used to answering to David Stein for almost 18 years. I basically answer to both. The people who have always known me as Stein call me Stein. The people who used to know me as Cole call me Cole. I suppose David, the one common denominator is Dave. So at least I'll always answer to David or Dave. But
I answer to Scott sometimes, because all through growing up, when I had an identical twin, people would just screw up, and I'm like, wait, that person wants my attention, and he thinks I'm his brother.
My situation reminds me of something I once heard George Takei from Star Trek say. He just got sick and tired of people not knowing whether it was George Takei or George Takei. He answers to both. You can say, hey, George Takei, hey, George Takei. And you hear talk shows where they call him both, like in the same show, and he's totally cool with it. And I think that's kind of a nice, relaxed attitude to have. Takei, he's still George. So I'm Stein, I'm Cole, but I'm still Dave.
Yeah, I get Lion in Japan sometimes because they have a hard time with R's and L's.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just let it be, you know.
And so. I never saw the point in being mean and correcting people unnecessarily if they mean well and they just get it wrong.
Well, they literally can't hear the difference. They don't have an L in the language, so.
Yeah.
Well, I want to get into Michael Shermer a bit, as interesting as this is, because we said we'd take him to the woodshed. It is time to kill the shill. But before playing that audio, I think it would be good to, because we talked off air one time about this. People know that you got beat up by, you got ganged, really. But if you could recount that story, because I think this is important to show, because Michael Shermer is putting this stuff out in his magazine, calling you a racist and saying all these horrible things that he knows is not true, not only about your work, but about yourself. And that puts you in physical harm, and he still never retracted it. So I'd like to, if it's okay, to go over that story a little bit first, and then we'll play the audio.
Yeah, definitely. One thing I want to say is the first two times I got beat up in the early 90s, the first two times, even though it was the JDL who did it both times, the first two times I feel were my fault. I put myself in jeopardy in 91 and 92 by speaking to crowds where there was no security, where there was absolutely no barrier between the angry crowd and me. Now, that doesn't excuse someone who's going to...
That's still not your fault.
But all the same, exactly. I mean, if somebody says, I don't like this speech, therefore I'm going to go up and punch the speaker, that is bad no matter what. But I should have known better. The third time that I got beat up, which was the most serious, because the first couple times were just bumps and bruises, but nothing that lasted terribly long. The third time came a couple of months after Shermer's Skeptic magazine article where he said I was a racist and my work was worthless, and he implied, I mean, he straight out said I was a racist, and then he implied that I was a revisionist for nefarious purposes.
Racist towards Jews.
We are racing, Lord knows towards whom he was even talking about. So about 2 months after that article came out, he in his Skeptic magazine, I was much more severely beaten, not at an event, not where I had put myself in harm's way by speaking to an angry crowd, but
it was Thanksgiving, right?
Yeah, it was the night before Thanksgiving, and I was walking back to my apartment in Culver City, California. I was walking back after getting some groceries, and a car full of JDL thugs, or at least affiliates. Irv Rubin was not one of them. He he farmed this job out, either intentionally or simply by putting it out there on the website and hoping other people would do it. But a car full of JDL thugs pulled up alongside of me. Me in my naivete, when I saw the car pull up along, this was a very quiet street, Exposition Boulevard, in Culver City, a pretty quiet street. And when I saw the car pull up alongside of me, I thought it was someone who needed directions. I actually walked towards it. That's how ill-prepared I was for what was about to happen. And then I see one guy stays behind the wheel and three dudes jump out of the car, and they just start wailing on me really, really, really bad. I woke up on the pavement with a broken nose and a massive cut over my eye, I'd never been beat up to that extent before, not in the previous two times as a revisionist, and I'd never been beat up in school, even though I was a fairly small, weak kid. No one really picked on me, so this was a first, and it was that's what really put the realization in my head of the danger I was in. I think the thing that struck me, Rye, is that I realized I had been out cold for I don't know how many minutes. Not a long time, but maybe a minute or two.
That's a long time to be knocked out. I mean, usually it's seconds.
And anything could have happened to me at that point. I mean, I was helpless. I could have been stabbed. I could have had my head stomped. I could have had my neck stomped. I mean, any number of things could have happened while I was unconscious there on the sidewalk. And that's one of the things that really made me take the Jewish Defense League seriously. Now, at that point, the offer for my life was only $4,000. They were being cheapskates. I'm not going to make a stereotypical Jewish joke about that. I mean, I can get away with it being Jewish myself, but I'm not going to make a Jewish cheapskate joke. But they were being a little cheap. It wasn't until 97 that they upped the bounty to $25,000. But back then in 94, it was only 4,000. But
could you see when you got up?
Not out of one eye. My right eye, and there's still a massive scar over it that you can see up close. It's not big enough that you can see it from a distance. But the right eye, I couldn't see out of at all, and I couldn't breathe through my nose. It was I could only cough and breathe through my mouth. So I could see through my left eye enough to be able to. I was disoriented, and I had the choice to either continue towards my apartment or double back and try to make it to my folks' house. And I figured the best thing to do would be to go to my folks' house because I lived alone, and I thought it would be best to have my folks help me out. So I ran towards my folks' place, left all my groceries on the sidewalk. Amazingly, they were still there. After I went to the ER with my folks, got cleaned up, got stitches, I don't know, several hours at least. And as my dad is driving me back to my apartment, friggin' groceries are still on the sidewalk hours later. A testament to the fact that it was not a half bad area to live in. Nobody came by and took my cranberry sauce and the other little things that I had left there. But I still have the scar. I have the scar on my nose, and I have the scar above my eye. One of the things that I didn't talk about too much in the book, but with Shermer, when he admitted that he lied about what he said about me in his Skeptic article. Now, his magazine came out quarterly, if I remember back then. So there were four a year. And the next one that came out after the one that defamed me, he had a bunch of retractions in there, other revisionists. He apologized to the guy who was then head of the Institute for Historical Review, not Mark Weber, but a fellow named Tom Marcellus. He apologized to Tom Marcellus for claiming that Marcellus had once worked for the Church of Scientology. He apologized to several people retracted several things. Mine was the one thing that he didn't correct or retract, even though he is so blatant in the recordings I have with him, that that he lied about me being a racist, and he lied about my work being worthless, and yet that he would not print a correction or attraction. He simply refused to. He did it for other people, including other revisionists, but he didn't do it in my case. To me, that showed that this was that there was something personal going on there. That there was something that he specifically, where he was specifically targeting me, or at the very least wanting to do some amount of harm, because it's not like he was against correcting things about revisionists. Like I said, he corrected something about the head of the IHR.
Well, this is after he got owned on national television?
Yeah, I think part of it is that at that point, by the time the next Skeptic magazine came out, I had already given a speech at the IHR where I told the story, the backstory of what happened on the Donahue show, and how Shermer stabbed me in the back on that. And it's about a 45-minute speech.
We went over that last show if people missed it.
Yeah, and I'm going to digitize that. I only have it on VHS, but I'm going to digitize it in the next week or so. I'd like to put that online. And I think that Shermer got very pissed off that I gave the story away to the crowd at the IHR. So I think from that point on, it just became a matter of pride with him that he was not going to give an inch about retracting or correcting anything. One story that I don't tell in the book, and here's a reason I don't tell this particular story that I'm about to tell. One reason I don't tell it in the book, I was very committed in the book to only talking about things where they're about which I had objective proof. In other words, recorded conversations or letters from Shermer or emails from Shermer. Because everything in the book, I wanted to be able to say, well, here's Shermer's own words backing that up. There was one story that Shermer never copped to when he and I started talking again last summer. He admitted to everything else. He admitted to lying about me being a racist. He admitted to treating me unfairly. That he admitted to last summer. But there's one story that he wouldn't cop to, and yet it's a story that I know to be true, and it's probably the most foul thing he did. The only reason I didn't put it in the book is because, in part because I wanted to be able to show proof in Shermer's own words of everything I say. And
I
also,
don't know, he's being accused of something even more foul, but go ahead.
Oh, indeed. Oh, definitely. And that's definitely a whole nother story about what Shermer's going through now and what he may possibly have done. And also for the sake of my publishing company's legal department, I wanted to be able to show proof for anything that I said about Shermer. But the story I didn't tell was in January of 98, in late 97, that's when the JDL upped the reward offer to $25,000. And that's when I decided to capitulate to them. I was living with a young lady, and I think I've told this story before. I didn't want that burden on my head anymore. So it was in January of 98 that I made a deal with Irv Rubin, who was then head of the JDL. I paid him off, and I gave him a letter of apology and a very over-the-top, ridiculous letter of recantation that he demanded I get notarized, which I did. And he put it up on the JDL website. He killed his own buzz, because when he put the letter of recantation up on the website, he introduced it by saying, "Haha, behold the power of the JDL. Look what we made this man do." And you're not really supposed to brag like that when you force someone to recant. You're supposed to say, "Oh, he did this of his own free will and his own volition." You're not supposed to say, "Haha, look how powerful I am. I forced this guy to do that." No one bought the recantation except Rubin. He and Earl Krugel, his partner in crime, both of whom are passed now, but they're about the only two people.
It looked like a Galileo apology.
I purposely made it as over the top as humanly possible. And as I said, no one bought it. Ruben and his buddy were like the only two.
It's actually like some of the confessions at Nuremberg. Like, yeah, a tank engine.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's how phony confessions are manufactured. Is people say, "You agree to this? You better agree to this. If you don't agree to this, we'll do so and so." And you're like, "Yeah, yeah, sure, I agree, of course." And when I gave him the recantation along with the check, I flew out to British Columbia with the young lady I was living with, who was from Vancouver. And we stayed there for a while. Now, I thought everything was done. I gave Ruben the money. I gave him the recantation. He took the death threat off. He announced on the JDL website that the death threat was now nullified and the $25,000 reward bounty was done, over. And I thought, great, perfect. I'm free of this. I stay in British Columbia for about a month, maybe. And I come back to LA with the young lady, and we start figuring out we're going to set up house and do all these things. And I get a call from Ruben, and he's furious. Irv Ruben is furious at me. Now, this threw me because I thought we were buddies now. I thought we had peace. I thought we had detente. And Ruben is very angry. And he says, "Did you lie to me? I hear that you lied to me. I'm being told that you lied to me, that your recantation is phony, and that you're making me look like a monkey." Now, it didn't take me to make Irv Ruben look like a monkey. The man actually did look like a gorilla. He was a big, scary-looking, massive gorilla of a man. So that wasn't my doing if he felt that he looked like a monkey. But I said to him, "Irv, no, I gave you the money, and the recantation is genuine." "Well, that's not what this Dr. Michael Shermer says. This Dr. Michael Shermer called me." What had happened was Shermer.
What a jerk.
Yeah, Shermer had read about the recantation about a month or so after it happened. And because back then, of course, news didn't travel as fast. The internet in early 98 wasn't what it is now. But about a month later or so, Shermer had heard about the recantation. And now he's not a dumb man. He reads the recantation. He knows me. He reads it and he knows that this isn't how I talk. So what does he do? He calls Irv Ruben. He calls the man who's been trying to get me killed. And he says, "You're believing this BS? Cole's taking you for a fool."
Now, was he aware that you had been beaten several times?
Oh, of course. Yeah, he knew all of that. He was
very. Oh, he's just such scum. I really hate him even more now.
And he's injecting himself into a story that doesn't even have anything to do with him. This is early 98. I haven't even spoken to Shermer since 94. And here's early 98, me and Ruben and our own business. And Shermer decides, for the pure sadism of it, that he's going to interject himself into this and call Irv Ruben to try to get Ruben riled up that my recantation is phony and that I'm making him look like a fool. Shermer did this not for any reason but pure sadistic cruelty and just because he's such a prick.
That's accomplice to murder. I mean, he's trying, he's calling somebody to get him pissed at you, who had already threatened to kill you and tried to hire people to kill you. I don't know how he got away with that, like posting online, "Hey, kill this person." I mean, I guess he did go to jail eventually, but...
Yeah, well, I made the conscious choice with the death threat not to go to the police and go to court because I didn't want to bring attention to it. Remember that back in 97, 98, it was still possible to keep stuff on the internet not that well known. because of the whole dynamics of the internet was so different back then. And I just didn't want to bring any attention to the death threat. but I could have gone to the police, obviously, because it was a criminal offense to seek someone's death and to pay for it. So anyway, here we are back in like February of 98, and Shermer has got Irv Rubin totally riled up. And Rubin is furious. But I say this every now and then only because I like to be kind of self-deprecating, make fun of myself. But I'm really not that dumb of a guy. I had to think on my feet during that conversation. And it occurred to me while Rubin was yelling at me, "Did you do this? Are you making me look like a monkey? Are you making me look like a monkey? Because this Dr. Sharma, he says you're making me look like a monkey." And I thought to myself, I bet that Irv Rubin doesn't know. I bet that Shermer didn't tell him that Michael Shermer was the star of the biggest selling videotape that the Institute for Historical Review offers. In 95, Shermer had done a video with Mark Weber at the Institute for Historical Review, where they had appeared together in a roughly 2-hour video discussing revisionism. And Shermer gave the IHR full rights to sell the video. Now, of course, to me, I liked the fact that Shermer and Weber debated and talked. I always, to me, debate's a perfectly rational way to deal with any topic. But I knew to Irv Rubin, the idea that Shermer collaborated with Mark Weber and the evil Nazi racist IHR, that would be something he would not want to hear. So I said to Rubin, I said, "Okay, Irv, calm down a sec. I want to let you know something about this Michael Shermer character. Do you know that he's the star of the biggest selling video the IHR has? That he and Mark Weber, they collaborated together? This is the man you're listening to. This is the man who you're taking your talking points from?" And Rubin hits the ceiling. He says, "What? What? That son of a bitch Shermer did a video with Mark Weber? What?" And keep in mind, Rye, that at this point in 98, I had not done anything public with revisionism since 95. So I had been out of the game for 3 years. So I was quiet. But the fact that Shermer had collaborated with Mark Weber and the IHR, Rubin didn't know that because Shermer didn't tell him that little detail. Shermer, the thing is, he was clumsy. Shermer was very clumsy in trying to come at me for just pure, mean, sadistic bastard reasons, while leaving himself open to the fact that he hadn't told Irv Rubin about his work with the IHR. So Rubin, there was an immediate sea change in the conversation. And Rubin says, "You know what, you've been good and you've been honest, and it's that Shermer who's the liar. Shermer's the one who lied to me." Irv Rubin was easily manipulated that way. He wasn't the brightest guy.
That's why he's in the JDL, because he's an idiot.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And you know, it was sort of like, it was almost like I did the Jedi mind trick on him. You know, he calls me up and he's like, "Michael Shermer says you're the bad guy." And then I'm like, "No, Michael Shermer's the bad guy." "Yeah, Michael Shermer's the bad guy." Sometimes the Jedi mind trick actually works if somebody is as dim as an Imperial stormtrooper. So Rubin, in his rage, in his anger, goes back and calls Michael Shermer and reams him out and says, "You son of a bitch, you didn't tell me you did a video with the Institute for Nazi Historical Review and Mark Nazi Weber, and that they sell your video with your approval. How they, what are you, you're trying to get nice Mr. Cole killed." Of course, it was always Rubin who was trying to get me killed, but Shermer was trying to throw some gasoline on the fire, and he got bit by it. Shermer had to contact his friend Alex Grobman, with whom he wrote a book that attacked me, a book called Denying History. And Alex Grobman is kind of a big shot in the LA Jewish community with links to various the LA Jewish organizations out here. And Shermer had to run to Alex Grobman crying, saying, Irv Rubin wants to kill me now. You gotta tell Irv Rubin to lay off. Tell Irv Rubin to lay off. Typical Shermer. He tried to make a play. He tried to make a gambit. I was able to turn it around on him. Alex Grobman had to step in like mommy and call Irv Rubin and say, no, Shermer's a good boy. He's a good boy. Don't go after him. He's a good boy. He made a mistake with the Weber video. He won't bother you again. I promise. He's a good boy. And it was quiet from that point on. Shermer never made another attempt to inject himself into my business again. This is the one story that Shermer won't cop to. All the stuff that he and I emailed about last summer, he copped to, all the lies and the distortions. But when I said, what about that time that you tried to rile up Irv Rubin and convince him that my recantation was phony? What about that? And Sherman's like, I don't remember that. No, I wouldn't have done that. These are things I don't forget. You don't tend to forget the stuff that involves you almost getting killed. It's one of those things, you know, like the birth of your first child or your wedding day, or the day you lose your virginity. You don't forget the stuff that involves you almost getting murdered. It's a true story. But I don't have with Rubin being dead. And Shermer unwilling to admit to that story. I don't have any objective evidence for it other than my own memory. So for that reason, I didn't put it in the book. But it's a very good, but it's a true story, and it's a very good indictment of Shermer's character that 4 years after we had stopped speaking, he still felt the need to throw himself into a situation where I was in peril, where I had just bailed myself out. And he still felt the need to try to make things worse for me and try to bring more harm to me. That shows malice, and it's that level of malice if you combine it with the fact that he admits that he lied to me lied about me in the past. And that
This is a guy who's used to opening easy doors, as you said before.
Yeah,
you know, he'll argue with religious fanatics, which is kind of like arguing with a child. Or he'll argue, you know, about Loch Ness Monster or something where there's no way he can lose because the other side is trying to propose something completely idiotic. And, you know, he went on Donahue thinking, you know, I'm a doctor, and and he just got taken to the woodshed over the Holocaust. Yeah. I mean, he just looked like a goof. And Donahue had to talk about your bar mitzvah and other irrelevant crap. And I think he was really, that was his, you know, embarrassing moment, and it was on national television. Of course, he wouldn't have been on TV if you hadn't got him on there anyway, but he had a vendetta against you. You know, he's used to winning arguments against easy opponents, and he just didn't know what he was doing, even when you gave him all the talking points, because he's wrong. But I mean, what a vindictive ass to rouse someone up who'd already tried to kill you. Years after, and this isn't even to profit like before with his magazine. He's trying to, you know, hit the hornet's nest and cause controversy, maybe sell some books. But this wouldn't have even mattered if you tried to do it secretively. I mean, this makes me question his other case in trouble that he's in even more, a lot more.
Yeah, he's a guy of very low character. People look at me sometimes and they say, well, dude, you recanted in 98, then you hid in a whole different world and now you're back. I understand that there are questions about my character as well in terms of how I fled the scene, started a new life, and then was somewhat unwillingly thrust back into it. But there's a big difference between what I felt I needed to do to keep myself and my family safe and what Shermer has done, which is maliciously going out there to slander people, to defame people, and then in the case with Rubin, to actually try to get a murderous fellow riled up again. I mean, by 98, it was well known that Irv Rubin had his hand in murders, pipe bombings, car bombings, arson. That was not something that people were even debating anymore by 98. So
yeah, he went to jail and died in jail too.
Well, yeah, a couple of years later after that is when he finally overplayed his hand. In the months after 9/11, he just went too far. And too far even for the FBI and the federal authorities. They finally cracked down on the guy. But he had slid. He had slid on a lot of charges. He had slid on a murder for hire charge, something that didn't even have to do with politics. In the early to mid-90s, he got out from under a kind of sort of typical you pay me and I'll kill a guy thing that didn't even have to do with Judaism, Israel, the Holocaust, or anything.
Just pure mercenary. Yeah,
just pure mercenary stuff. He was always able to maneuver his way out of things. But after 9/11, that's when he finally went too far. These guys eventually will go too far. They'll eventually run out of luck. Rubin had been lucky. Like, for example, there was a married couple, the Mannings. The Mannings had been implicated in JDL crime, including a murder, accused of being involved in a murder. And the Mannings fled to Israel, and Israel wouldn't send them back. But the thing is, eventually the Mannings died. I think one of them died of cancer. I don't want to say because I don't quite remember what the other one died for. But the point is, it was like a lucky stroke for Irv Rubin that the Mannings never lived to have to come back and face what they did and maybe implicate him. The authorities in Orange County in Southern California, they knew for a long time that Irv Rubin had firebombed the Institute for Historical Review in the 80s, burned the building to the ground, thousands of books burned. I mean, a true book burning. People use that term a lot. Oh, you're a book burner. And they kind of use it in general to mean any kind of a censor. But Irv Rubin was an actual book burner in the most literal sense of the word. He burned a library down. And the authorities knew for a while that that's one of the things that was learned from the FBI interrogations and the FBI notes when Rubin and Earl Krugel were finally arrested after 9/11. It was learned that the authorities had known for a while that Rubin was the one who burned down the IHR building.
Yeah, the JDL should have the same kind of stigma as the KKK. I mean, just a bunch of racist, murdering idiots. And yet it's just, I don't know, it's got the J word in it, and so it's dignified.
And Rubin, it was always interesting to me how he was able to skirt not only justice, but the stigma. Like you said, that the stigma of the KKK, a very justifiable stigma that the Klan has, and the JDL was always able to skirt it. One example I give in my book, but I don't mind restating it here for your listeners. One of my best friends during my Republican days was the KABC radio talk show host, Larry Elder. He's a conservative. I hate calling him a black conservative because it just sounds silly. I don't call myself a white conservative, or he's a yellow conservative. He's a conservative, but he is a bit of a novelty, Larry Elder, is because he's black. And he kind of staked out that territory of being the black conservative, kind of libertarian-leaning conservative. And Larry Elder and I, we were business partners. We were working on projects together. I was on his show every now and then. But we worked a lot together privately. Now, when Larry Elder and I would hang out, he didn't know I was Cole. And he would talk about his friendship with Irv Rubin. Because Larry Elder's been a fixture of LA talk radio and neocon talk radio nationally. He's always been stationed in LA, but his show used to be national. Larry Elder's been a neocon fixture for a good 20 years almost. And he and Irv Rubin used to be really, really tight. So here's Larry Elder. We're sitting in his palatial Mulholland Drive mansion, and he didn't drink, but I was sipping on wine. I think he was sipping on juice, and he's going on about his buddy Irv Rubin would have been able to beat that rap after 9/11 if he hadn't died in prison. And Irv Rubin's great. And I'm thinking to myself, putting aside that Larry Elder didn't know who he was talking to, that he didn't know he was talking to the David Cole, the man Irv Rubin had tried to get murdered. But Larry Elder was one of the first guys to always, always bitch and moan about censorship against him, because leftist groups were always targeting him. They were targeting his advertisers. They were targeting the stations he worked for. When he went national, they targeted his national syndicator. And Larry was never one to refrain from whining about that. Oh, look what they've done. They're censoring me. They're attacking me. They're censoring me and they're attacking me. Now, I'm not a big fan of advertiser boycotts. It's just not my thing. I'm a big fan of the personal boycott. For me, the personal boycott is if you don't like a show, you just don't listen to it. And if you don't like the fact that Procter & Gamble advertises on that show, then you don't buy their products. But I'm not a huge fan of trying to force anyone off the air for any reason. I prefer a society in which there's lots and lots of vibrant and contradictory speech. I think we profit from that more than if we try to force anybody, right, left, center, whatever, off the air. So I don't agree with what the leftist groups would do to Larry Elder. But when Larry would whine and whine about the censorship that was being directed at him with these advertiser boycotts, I would think to myself, I wouldn't say it, but I'd think to myself, but my God, sir, you were friends with Irv Rubin. Irv Rubin burns buildings to the ground and burns books and punches people and threatens people's lives and occasionally kills people. That's a little bit heavier than an advertiser boycott. I'm not a fan of advertiser boycotts, but I sure as hell am not a fan of killing people and burning books.
That's a classic hypocrite. You see that on the left and right.
Yeah.
They hate censorship, but they want to censor the other side.
Yeah, exactly. And it was Larry Elder generally was a rational man in a lot of areas. But he was very irrational when it came to how much he liked Irv Rubin and the JDL, how much he approved of what they did, and how he was unable to see the hypocrisy. He was unable to see that at the same time that he was moaning and complaining and whining about these advertiser boycotts, and moaning and whining about the censorship, at the same time, he was totally fine with a group that censors people with pipe bombs and arson and death threats.
Well, I see that a lot, actually. I mean, it's weird how people have blinders, because you'll have leftists or people on the right, actually, who may stand up for civil rights in America, and they want equal rights. And they talk about maybe police prejudice towards African Americans and things in America. But then you talk about the African migrants in Israel or the Palestinians, and they're just like, well, F them, you know. Who cares how they get treated? Even when they're getting murdered, it doesn't matter. Because I don't know if it's religion or the political identity or whatever, but there is this ability where people can be perfectly rational in a certain sphere, but in another category, even though it's pretty much the exact same situation, they just don't see it or acknowledge it.
The same thing went for the group Friends of Abe, the group of Hollywood Republicans and conservatives that I worked with for over 5 years. Most of their meetings, most of the Friends of Abe meetings, were all complaining, bitching and whining. Oh, poor us. The leftists don't give us a chance. They don't hire us. They look down on us, they insult us on the set, et cetera, et cetera. Now, a lot of times that does happen. Hollywood is a left-leaning town, and I know from experiences that my friends have had, it does happen that the left can be very, very intolerant. Of course, the right can as well, that both sides can. But in Hollywood, the left has a bit of an upper hand. So it's not like the complaining was totally unjustified, but this group of people who went for over 5 years, we'd get together at all manner of meetings and talk about freedom, man, freedom to talk, freedom to express ourselves. Oh, that's all we want. We don't want to dominate the town. We just want freedom to speak our opinions. The minute these people learned about my past as Cole, not only did they banish me, I mean, I was officially banned from the group. I was served a letter of lifetime banishment. But not only that, what's funnier and more interesting is that they mirrored the language of the left, the language that they themselves, that some of them had been subjected to over the years. When a friend of mine would stick by me, for example, if a female friend would stick by me, the friends of Abe would say, oh, well, that's just because she's a woman and she doesn't understand complicated issues. So,
what?
Yeah, but I quote an actual email from one of the friends of Abe, a guy who was one of the special effects guys on Avatar and a couple of other big budget films, and that was his take on it. He said, it's amazing that a couple of women in the group are still sticking by Stein, but it's just because they're women and they don't get the issues involved. So the right became the very stereotype, where because the left will say these conservatives are anti-woman, and the conservatives will say, no, we're not. We're pro-woman. We're not. And then, but as soon as I enter the picture and this and my controversy enters the picture, all of a sudden it becomes not just going.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of pressure and their prejudice comes out. I mean, they can barely hide it. Yeah.
And there was a case of a friend of mine of 30 years, a woman I've known since high school who's black, and they went racial on her. Again, the very stereotype that the left likes to force on the right, saying you guys are racists, and as soon as this friend of mine of 30 years didn't abandon me, the fact she was black, they went racial on her. They said, you're a sellout, you're an Uncle Tom, you might as well be friends with the leader of the Klan. And you know, they had to make it racial in her case. It was embarrassing to me to see these people who I had called friends for over 5 years devolve to a state where they are attacking the gender and the race of the people who happen to still be my friends. It was just plain embarrassing.
If they're white, they'd call them a Nazi. I mean, that's all they can do, though, when it comes to revisionism. They think the only possible motivation, forget about truth, the only possible motivation someone could have to not believe hook, line, and sinker every single aspect of the Holocaust narrative from the government is because they're a racist. And they couldn't possibly just look at the physical evidence and say, I don't think there's enough here to make this case or this number doesn't matter. Instead, the hell with that. It's the only reason you could deny the government's story on a war, because the government never lies about war or post-war, you know, is because you have to be an evil racist.
Yeah, and in fact, to
it's
cycle
like,
back,
oh, you don't support the war in Iraq, you hate the troops, you know?
Yeah, it's that simple-minded black and white, good guy, bad guy, black hat, white hat kind of thinking that all ideologues of both sides are prone to. And to cycle it back to Shermer, one of the reasons why I think Shermer and the transcripts and the recordings that I have of him, why I think they're important, is that Shermer made a pledge to his readers when he began covering revisionism. He made a pledge that he would be objective. Now, if you see an article about revisionism in the Wiesenthal Center newsletter or the newsletter of some B'nai B'rith temple or something like that, there's kind of an assumption that any smart person will have that, okay, there's definitely a measure of bias here. Obviously, the Wiesenthal Center, they they make their money primarily from pimping out the worst of the atrocity stories. And
Norman Finkelstein calls it the Holocaust industry.
Yeah, yeah. And these organizations like the ADL and the Wiesenthal Center and the Jewish Federation, I mean, they are it's not hard to see the bias there. But Shermer came at this thing as though he's Mr. Objective. Hey, I don't have a dog in this fight. I am going to be objective because I'm a skeptic and I don't have a bias. That's why the recordings I have of him, and which will play in a few seconds, the recordings that I have of him, where he admits that he slanted his article and that he purposely soft-pedaled and misled his readers about the flaws in the gas chamber Final Solution story. It's important with Shermer in a way that it's not as important with the ADL, because the ADL don't necessarily try to hide their bias. I mean, it doesn't mean that they claim to be frauds. It just means that a reasonable person will say, oh, well, the Anti-Defamation League of an Eye Breath, they're probably pretty geared towards the Jewish side of things. But Shermer, who, by the way, is not Jewish, and that's I see every now and then online, I see people say, well, typical Shermer, he's a Jew. No, Shermer's not Jewish. Shermer is just your average Lutheran white dude. He used to be a born-again Christian in his younger days, but he's not Jewish, and I just want to make that point, because it's an easy go-to thing for some people to just say, well, of course he says that, he's Jewish. No, Shermer's not Jewish, but... And Shermer made the point very strongly to his readers, hey, I'm going to be objective. And I don't have a bias. In fact, that was a major part of his supposed takedown of revisionists in Skeptic magazine. He said, they're the ones with the bias. People like me, we're the ones who realize that... you can be an unbiased historian. You can be unbiased. You can overcome bias. So when Shermer admits to me...
He's not a historian.
Yeah. That's he's... in fact, on the Donahue Show...
If he's an historian, Caroline Coles is an archaeologist.
Well, it's...
this is a lady that finds debris on the surface, is like, there it is. It must have been sitting here for 70 years.
Oh, that is, you know, that was such a ridiculous venture, that whole supposed excavation.
I hate to cut it off right there, folks, but part two will be up shortly. You are listening to the ANC Report with Ryan Dawson. The guest was David Cole. We have more information on Michael Shermer and his shenanigans, Shermer the Squirmer. You will be able to hear that first on this show before it goes anywhere else on the web. Thank you, David Cole, for giving me that premiere and that opportunity and privilege. Please donate in the link below. The campaign has just a little bit over a week left to go. We are about 62% of the way there. Please donate today, and be sure to check back tomorrow and get part two. It is explosive.